Welcome to the Winter Palace. I'm your host, Mark Cole, editor and publisher of Odessa Steps Magazine. Today, we welcome back Lucha World's Vandal Drummond to the show to talk about the Rey de Aris match last week between Volador Jr. and Barbaro Cavernario, the polarizing finish of that match, their rematch this week, Cavernario's main event future, the recent CMLL Legends show, how not all 55-year-old wrestlers are Negro Casas, and more. We then talk about one of the most famous foreign objects in wrestling history and how Vandal acquired his own version of it, famous blinding angles, and the importance of context when watching a match from the past. We also talk about his European vacation in the summer, including being in London post-Brexit, Paris post-Nice, and how he would like a return trip to Edinburgh. We close talking about the next Lucha World pod with his co-host Alfredo Esparza, other podcasts Kurt has done recently, and the smorgasbord of wrestling to watch online. Thanks for listening. We hope you enjoy the show.
There's a man in the funny papers we all know.
It's never a bad time to have our next guest on, to talk about the world of Lucha Libre, his European vacation, and other bits and bobs. We welcome back to the show our friend Vandal Drummond. How's it going?
It is going really well, Mark. How you doing?
I am good. I guess we'll start with what's most current, and that is CMLL's show the other night. We had the Rey de Aris final between Volador and Cavernario. It was a really good match with a very questionable finish, and I know friends of ours on the internet have been divided about how it was really clever or really annoying. So where do you weigh in on that?
I joined the side very clever. You know, like a lot of old school fans who have seen hundreds of screw finishes, I think it didn't bother me because I get annoyed when there's a match where there's potential screw finishes throughout the entire match when, hundreds of wrestlers are involved in run-ins and yada yada, or if it's a really, like, far-fetched finish. But I liked this one. I thought it was perfect for a wrestler like Cavernario to, do something almost pranksterous, like, make it look like Volador was the one who gave Tarantes, the low blow. And I also love it because it wasn't one of the things where Tarantes was the heel referee, judging, solely based that he's a heel referee. He really thought that Volador kicked him in the crotch, and it was perfect how Volador had Cavernaria in his own hold, the Cavernaria, and Tarantes is waving, and all the fans believe, it went to Volador. And it's setting up a longer-term feud between them, and I am just happy that Cavernario was featured in the main event in the final with a wrestler as great as Volador Jr. And damn, both guys turned it on. And was it the show 2 weeks before, I think, where Cavernario wrestled Valiente in a lightning match?
Yeah, he was supposed to wrestle Máscara Dorada, but that was like the week that Dorada had gone and wrestled on Monday Night Raw, and then
Okay.
People were wondering, is he gone or is he not? But he's since come back and he's not left for good yet. But I know a lot of people were certainly looking forward to seeing Cavernario wrestle Dorada.
Definitely looking forward to that, but I enjoyed his match with Valiente, and the reason I bring it up is I'm way behind on my wrestling viewing. I know that's a running joke on Lucha World, but what I love seeing is I love seeing Cavernario in singles matches. He's obviously great in six-man tags. He's just a great worker. But when he's wrestling single matches, I mean, it really shines just how good he is. I mean, the way, I mean, he just made Valiente shine. I love Valiente, but I think you have to put a little something extra in it to really get him over. And Cavernario just really put him over strong.
What?
I mean, he's a guy who's trying to get it over, not just himself. He's trying to get the production over, the show.
Well, it's funny that he, all of those guys who really shone in the, not last year's Busca di Anillo, but the year before when the final four were Dragon Lee, Cavernario, Hechicero, and now the Panther. And it's funny that Dragon Lee's really the only one who has really had a sustained top of the card push. It's Cavernario sort of floats in that sort of upper mid card area, and unfortunately, Hechicero and the Panther seem to just be sort of stuck in the mid card. But it seemed like for a while, Cavernario got a really big push after Busca, but then it just sort of faded away, and it seems like, he's one of those guys you don't see for a couple weeks, and then he comes back and he's teaming with, he's like the fill-in Peste Negra, like if Mr. Niebla is suspended or Negro Casas is injured.
Or as I call him, if he's off being Dr. Jerry Niebla for the evening.
Right. So, but hopefully this is the renewal of his push, 'cause when you have all of those guys that were in the Rey de Air, that you could have put in the final, because I think we all sort of kind of maybe knew that Volador would be in the final because he seems to get to the finals of everything right now. Like, he's probably their number one guy on the depth chart. But
Oh, he is.
you could have had, you could have done, Mystico or Caristico, or you could have had him wrestle Mephisto again, because Mephisto seems to be the guy they like to go to for like main event to use as a base in big matches, whether it's Mystico or Volador. So I was very happy to see Cavernario end up in this match, and like I said, we'll get to see them in a rematch this week, and it could very well be that they're building towards a hair match. Maybe, I mean, it's now October, so maybe those beginning of the year shows that they run, that could be a target for
That
them.
would be awesome, and I think it would, I think it would draw pretty healthy too. I mean, I loved that match. One of the things enjoying that match the other night was not only was I digging it, but you could hear the crowd popping for it too, and that just makes a match all the stronger,
It does make you wonder, though, with them wrestling again this week, what they really did not leave many tricks in the bag after that match. They pretty much did almost all other big spots. It's like,
Absolutely. That was like, I'm more into the whole ambience of pro wrestling than the 5-star matches. But when I see like a 5-star match like that, it's like, I just love it. I mean, yeah, I don't know what they're gonna do next. It'll be interesting to see if they put any kind of spin on it.
hopefully he does not take that sunset flip to the floor again,
That weirds me out.
because we know that when Volador did that to Negro Casas at the beginning of the year, it pretty much put Casas, on and off for like a good, couple months, that he wasn't really wrestling regularly after that for a while.
It seems like such, it's a gnarly looking bump, but is it worth it? I mean, Cavernario, I mean, they pulled out almost every other move in the book. There's some I think you should just kind of leave in the kitchen sink and not throw out there. I mean, Cavernario's dive, his tope from the or plancha from the turnbuckle to the floor, doesn't freak me out as much because it's not good for his knees. But the way he's landing, it looks like he knows to kind of how would I say, lessen the impact on his knees. I mean, it's very brief, but when you see him doing, you're seeing one of the legs, the knee pointing out, which was when I was. It's funny. I don't hear about, wrestlers I know. I don't hear about the Ming Tapis, and I'm talking strictly on an indie level wrestlers I know on indie level, where when you throw a drop kick, even when you land, I was always taught to put your left leg, have that land flat on the mat frontwards, but your right leg, you kind of put your leg out, but bent a bit. And it takes so much of the impact off your knees. It was a huge difference, because I remember I used to be throwing drop kicks and landing just with both knees on the ground. And after a while, it gets tender. And I remember, of all people, it was Dr. Jerry Graham who just chewed me out, saying that's the stupidest way to land. And sometimes that's suggested to younger wrestlers, and they just look at me like, "What? Why would I want to do that?" And you're crazy, old man. So that's the
But,
grumpy old man in me. My grumpy man rant for the day.
well, speaking of grumpy old men, I know that you also watched the CML show from a couple weeks ago that had all of the legends in it, and it's. I think the main takeaway from that show was, once again, how amazing Nedgor Casas is when you have many of the legends working on that show that are now retired, and there's Casas still a main event worker. And some of those guys, it was, it's always kind of bittersweet when you see like guys in their, mid-50s or maybe even older working matches, and it's not quite the same. It's like it's good that they're still out there, given the
Yeah,
alternative, given the alternative.
bittersweet.
But
Bittersweet's the way to put it.
seeing Canek or Dos Caras or the Capos, it was just like, this is a good idea on paper, but not always the best in
Absolutely, and
execution.
I should not have had like Los Hermanos Dinamita and those guys in the main event. It's almost like, maybe this sounds sacrilegious to some, but the Leyendos portion of the show probably should be done in the middle of the show and maybe the co-main event. On one hand, it's kind of cool to see that, like you said, Negro Casas, just the pop he got alone, and the other is his idol, Negro Navarro. That guy is in such amazing shape for a 60-something-year-old man. The spot that just blew my mind was when his team put over the Technicos, how he went and Mano Negra finished him off with like a body slam, and I can't remember what else he finished him with, but Mano Negra was one of those guys, like you're saying, is probably in decent shape for your average human being, but probably shouldn't be in the ring anymore. And it looked like Negro Navarro like body slammed himself. I just thought that was so amazing. And his mat work is just flawless.
Well, it's
Same with
amazing.
Solar.
Well, it's amazing that those guys are still, working on a regular basis. Admittedly, it's often against each other, and they probably have their matches down cold. But still, just to be able to do the things that some of those guys are doing, in their mid-50s and older.
Yeah, I mean, we've seen Fredo and I have seen Negro Navarro live on one on a legend show that was out here in El Monte about a year and a half ago. And not only was his mat work just sweet to watch, well, it's on, Fredo's Lucha World, but we were able to nab an interview with him, and he was one guy who was so generous with his time. I mean, he didn't say, "Okay, let's get this over with. I've got stuff to do." He gave Fredo all the time in the world. Really nice guy, and just, I mean, I'd say if there's one thing that's a takeaway, is if you kind of look at the style he wrestles. I still think, even though the business has changed and evolved, as it always does, I think you could do some of that mat work he does and kind of lessen all the wear and tear on the body, because you see guys doing, you know, all these topes and planches and high impact moves in, you know, throughout the entire match. And I actually think it makes the match a little more dramatic if you start off doing some hold-for-hold wrestling in that style. And audiences love it. Everywhere I've seen them do really good hold-for-hold after a good little session of back and forth, audiences love it. I remember an indie show like 10 years ago, just a local one, a place that probably only seated like 300 people, but Dos Caras and Blue Panther wrestled in the main event. And it was all just technical wrestling, maybe a few high spots. But after each round of going hold for hold, the whole audience was just clapping, like not screaming, like clapping, like they just saw something brilliant. And 10 minutes into the match, the whole audience starts chanting Lucha Libre. And Dos Caras went over clean. And after the match, Blue Panther, I can't remember exactly how he said it, but he took the microphone and just, in Spanish, thanked the audience, saying, "Wow, it's so great to wrestle in front of people who understand Lucha Libre." And so I always thought it would be great. You could still do the moves you're doing today, but start off with a bunch of mat wrestling, then kind of build up the tension, then, you know, kick it into the next gear and start doing all the high spots and build it to a climax. But that's just me. That's just my inner booker.
Well, it's also interesting that when you see some of the CML guys, when they go to work indie shows, you know, they it seems like the ones that can do a lot more of that kind of mat work, intricate stuff, because in general, it seems like the Arena Mexico audience, you know, is quick to, you know, whistle that, because they just want to see high flying. But if you look at, you know, the people that you would expect, like Virus or Hechicero and guys, you know, and even like Puma and Tiger, when they go to do indie shows, you know, they get to do stuff they don't normally get to do when we see them on TV.
Yeah. And also, there's really good hold-for-hold wrestling, and there's also lame hold-for-hold wrestling. And I think fans will grow impatient if you're just doing the same three moves. But somebody like Negro Navarro, in fact, Fredo and I were interviewing Los Tramas on, actually twice, and they were saying that with their dad, they have just this sketchbook full of, like, hundreds and hundreds of holds that are either conventional holds or holds that they kind of like dreamed up on their own over the years. And whenever Fredo and I see them, the first thing we're saying, "Where's that book of holds? We want it published." And it's nothing they plan to publish, but we can dream.
Yeah, hopefully, like we were saying, that maybe this week on TV we could see something like that, because the Lightning match on Tuesday is Hechicero and Guerrero Maya Jr. And those are two guys that always seem to work together. And, you know, with only 10 minutes, there may not be as much mat stuff as you might like, but that still hopefully will be an entertaining match.
I think it will. Those guys are awesome. Talk about, and both of them guys that should be pushed way more than they are.
I'm going to be really curious to see, because I'm going to go to the Ring of Honor show in Baltimore at the end of the month when the CML guys are coming in for that six-man tournament. And I know Rob has been very vocal in saying that, you know, the ROH fans should presumably really love Hechicero's style, because it does sort of fit that ROH mold. So I'm curious to see how that's going to go over, because it's still supposed to be Ultimo Guerrero, Hechicero, and Okamura, and they're wrestling Daniels, Kazarian, and Kamatachi. So you have a whole bunch of guys that should be familiar with each other. So I'm hoping that's going to be really entertaining.
It sounds promising, very promising.
Like you said, you do not watch as much as you probably would like. Is there anything else that you've seen lately that floated your boat?
No, to be honest, I have been kind of disappearing into the time machine. I've been spending a lot of time researching newspaper archives, and what started that was I was really curious about Charo Aguayo, who was the first heavyweight superstar in Mexico. And what struck my curiosity for years now was I never saw a really thorough bio written of him, even though all the Lucha mags, salute him as, the first major star, heavyweight star in pro wrestling in Mexico. And the other thing that just really sparked my interest was every bio of him says, about his wrestling career in Mexico, mentioned a little bit about Texas, and then they say he died in 1963 in Memphis, Tennessee. And for years, I was asking people, like, hey, do you know anything about, like, why was he in Tennessee? What was he doing there? And I even did searches for him, finding pretty much nothing. But then finally, just when I was going over some archives in this newspaper, The Tennessean, I just did a search for Francisco Aguayo, and they had his obituary. And what I didn't realize was he was on the Tennessee wrestling scene with the Gulas family, kind of as jack of all trades, wrestler, referee. I have a hunch he might have maybe run some of the towns. But he was under the name Don Cortez, so it's very fascinating where here was this guy who was this just not only was a huge name in Mexico, but he was huge in Texas, New Mexico, and to some extent California. And I found it interesting that when he went to Tennessee, he decided to take the moniker Don Cortez and just kind of, lessen his visibility. I mean, he was hiding in plain sight, but, and of course, 6 degrees of separation. Once I started researching on him, I started learning about Mexican American stars like Vincent Lopez and Jimmy El Pulpo, who was a huge draw in California and is almost forgotten in the history books today.
Speaking of history, you have been boasting on your Facebook page about a purchase that you made that longtime wrestling fans will recognize the name of what you bought. So why don't you tell us what this big secret was that you were so happy to unveil recently?
It was the greatest surprise, the most unexpected surprise, because I was not even looking for the item in itself. But I think 2 years ago, I just did a search on Google for Monsell's powder. And Monsell's powder, old-timer fans will probably recognize, was the powder that John Tolles used to throw into Freddie Blassie's eyes in 1971 on TV. And it sparked their feud that wound up at the LA Coliseum of that same year and drew somewhere around 26,000 people, which I think was the highest gate for California at the time. And it's been mentioned a lot that wherever somebody has grown up in a wrestling territory, there's certain things the old-time fans all remember, even if they're not hardcore fans. Like the casual fans remember when Ray Stevens knee dropped Pepper Gomez on the throat and caused him to spit up blood. Everybody remembers that angle. And here in Southern California, it was, oh, I remember the night that Tolles threw the Monsell's powder into Blassie's eyes. And for years, everybody was wondering what this Monsell's powder was. And Dave, I don't know if it was he who found out or somebody wrote him But it wound up what Moss's powder was used for at the time was corner men would use it for boxers to stop the bleeding, massive bleeding and cuts. And most doctors use it as some sort of, how do I put it? Something gynecological, or something when women are giving birth, if there is a lot of sudden bleeding, it's something that they use as an emergency to kind of cut off some bleeding. And eventually, boxing outlawed the use of Moss's powder, but, it goes down in history as, John Tolles's evil weapon. And about 2 years ago when I did this search, I found a photo of an old can of Moss's powder, and I thought, oh, that's so cool. And I thought I saved a copy of it, and I was mistaken. I didn't. So I looked for it, a few weeks later, and the photo was taken down. So every now and then I'll just do a Google image search to see, wonder if I can find a picture of Moss's powder. And I always thought it would be cool to, have an artist do a rendition of the bottle and maybe put on the T-shirt like it's an advertisement for, for all your needs and great wrestling angles, get Moss's powder, something like that. So a few weeks ago, I decided I'll do another search. I didn't find a picture of a bottle. I actually found an actual bottle, a vial of Moss's powder for sale on eBay. And I just stared at it for a bit, saying, wait, this can't be right. And it was some seller who specializes in, apothecary antiques. And then I'm looking at it, and it was, $20. And I said, oh, my Lord, I'm there. So I have my vial of Moss's powder ready to go if anybody misbehaves. Or rather, if I misbehave, and, they are men of honor who want to accept a wonderful award on television, I can chuck it in their eyes now. I can dream.
It is funny that I think even, for people that a little longer, like my age, a little younger than you, it's like, that's one of those things that I really only know of because, it seems like once or twice a year, Dave will find a reason to somehow bring it up in the Observer. And it's just there's certain phrases that you've just grown accustomed to, especially, in sort of the area of foreign objects. It's like, to me, Moss's powder is like the equivalent of the Freebird hair cream.
Absolutely.
Because they.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And because they did the same. It's funny. They both did the same. It's the same angle. And in both of them drew humongous money off of it. It's sort of interesting that, we always say angles get repeated from territory to territory once they're successful. And yeah, it seems like the blinding angle, at least in the old days, always seemed to work because you had that one with Blassie, you had the Freebird hair cream with Junkyard Dog, you even had it in a different variety when they did the Sandman angle in ECW. It's maybe there must be something primal about people being blinded that people relate to.
Yeah, it was almost done in almost like a blue-collar performance art way where, from what I understand, both Junkyard Dog and Freddie Blassie would go everywhere with a bandage over his eyes. And, even though I think the fans still kind of knew it was a worked thing. I mean, if you sell the authenticity the best you can, and, now they do things where people get injured on TV and then they're back next week with a fully healed broken leg or that sort of thing, and it's done almost in a comical fashion. Where back then, they made it just look really gruesome. I mean, I started watching a year too late to see the Moss's powder angle myself, but I remember at the time they were pushing Ernie Ladd when he had the taped thumb gimmick and he would not let the referee inspect his taped thumb because he said it's an injury and referees are careless and injure it further. And, then he'd proceed to jab the much smaller baby face in the throat and they would start spitting up blood. And I remember, especially when he did it to Raul Mata, it was, as campy as LA wrestling was, that was the first thing I had ever seen where I really got freaked out. I mean, Mata was spitting up all this blood, and it's like all over his stomach, and he's lying there with his eyes half open and going into death spasms before Ruben Juarez came and like beat Ernie Ladd senseless with a shoe. it's like there was something that kind of, I think if you, like you said, if you do something really primal, emotional, you know, there's some, you know, I think it's going to sell or at least get critical appraisal. Where, you know, I think now things are done so tongue in cheek. It's almost they should go all the way tongue or cheek or not at all.
We talked about this a couple shows ago, and since, you know, you're a longtime person, did you get to see the last Battle of Atlanta footage yet?
No, I haven't yet. It's one I have. People have sent me over the last few weeks about 15 different videos to watch, and I am even more behind than I usually am. One guy, Kevin Orcutt, sent me several YouTube videos to watch involving people like Buddy Rose in his heyday. Well, there's a lot of stuff I'm going to catch up on, but the Battle of Atlanta is one of them I have bookmarked and am planning on watching.
It's funny, and now since the couple weeks since we did the show with Sempervivi, I've actually heard a number of people say the same thing I did, that it's ended up being underwhelming, and I don't know if it's because it's been hyped for so long, or my feeling is that it may have been sort of hot for 1983, but when it's just like two guys brawling in the middle of the ring and then running each other into the cage, it's sort of not that exciting anymore.
You know what I think part of the problem is, and I remember the last time when Brian Alvarez and Dave Meltzer interviewed Bruno Sammartino, he said something I think really kind of sums it up. He said he said people want to see his match with Stan Hansen in the cage, the famous New York match in 1976. And you know, then people are disappointed because Bruno was still badly hurt in that to do that match, and so they just had to do a quick thing where he just rides roughshod all over Hansen. And you know, I've never seen it actually, so I didn't even know how well it got over at the time. But something he mentioned was, if that's all they see, they're going to be disappointed. But if they could watch from the very first week of the angle and watch week by week of it building and the whole storyline of Bruno, you know, being in the hospital, that's what, you know, and I think the same might be with the Battle of Atlanta, is you didn't see the preceding buildup. I think there's a lot of matches where if you just went there and saw two guys just wailing the crap out of each other, you're going to say, oh, okay, I've seen this before. But if you knew their storyline, why they were wailing the crap out of each other, what wrong did one guy do the other? So I think people need to put that in perspective.
I know that's Matt's big thing is always context. Like, he doesn't like watching a match without the context.
Yes.
Because unless it's just something really, really, you know, like super, like I think,
because oh, exactly.
the thing that I was comparing the last Battle of Atlanta to is Magnum and Tully. But I think that match, all you have to do is say these two guys hate each other. And I think that's really all of the context you need for that match, because that match is so great.
Yes.
That I think it can exist in a vacuum. But yeah,
oh, exactly. I think if you want to get one, okay, say you have two guys in the ring that people have never seen before, you want to get that match over. I think you go about it a different way rather than just tearing into each other or just breaking out into high spots. One I remember, I mean, just off the top of my head, one of the more underrated journeymen who spent a lot of time here in LA was Tony Rocco. He loved to work stiff. I mean, he wasn't trying to hurt people, but it's just the way he liked to wrestle. And he is also, like, a hard worker and an amazing baby face. He, along, you know, there's several LA guys who were just master baby faces, and I think he was one of them. When he would make a comeback, he would have this look of rage on his face that looked real, very real, and you're thinking, oh no, that guy's going to get his lunch fed to him. And I remember there was a match when Mil Máscaras came to town. When he would wrestle on a Friday night, he would usually wrestle a match the previous Wednesday on live TV. And, gosh, I wonder if this tape exists, because I think it was 78 when people, in 1978 when people started recording both San Francisco and L.A. wrestling. But he and Máscaras were having a great scientific match. And, of course, Máscaras, and, you know, wherever he went, is kind of considered, you know, is billed as the Superman of wrestling. And Rocco, like halfway through the match, you know, is showing this frustration that he can't out-wrestle Máscaras, and at some point loses his cool and starts, like, wailing on Máscaras, you know, for present-day fans, this was back in the days where a babyface would rarely throw a punch unless he was already coaxed into it or wronged. Well, so Rocco kind of goes off on Máscaras, and then Máscaras makes his comeback, and he pins him with a body press, and then after the match, Rocco just kind of shakes his head and extends his hand like, I'm sorry, you were just too good for me, you know? And it got over really well. It was just a TV match, but it was a very well-executed one. And that's a match I bet if you watched today, you could say, wow, that really holds up. Even if you didn't, and there was no storyline between them. There was no angle. They just knew how to build, you know, tell a story in one match, you know, where, like you say, Battle of Atlanta, they were building something over time.
Yeah. The other thing that we wanted to talk about today was, I know you briefly talked about it on the pod with Fredo, was you had a rather lengthy European vacation during the summer, which ended up coming at like a really interesting time while you were over there. So since Fredo gave you short shrift to talk about it, I'd like to give you the opportunity to gush all you want about your trip.
Why, thank you. Oh, my God, it was a dream trip. One, Elena, my wife, is such an awesome, awesome vacation planner. She cashed in 17 years worth of miles that she, you know, of points she got through Alaska Air, and was able to get us first class the way there, the way back, which we never experienced before. And for a flight that long, I'm so glad she did that. Of course, we'll never have the chance to do that part of it again. But we spent a week in London, and we arrived just days after Brexit passed. And Brexit passed by, I think it was like 51% to 49%. So it was a very dividing issue whether they wanted to exit the union. And the first day we were in London, we went with two other couples that we're close to. And one of our friends, Dave Henderson, he had been to London several times. So Elena, our friend Zane and I, we decided, hey, let's go look around London. And he was going to show us around. So, you know, we're walking up and down the streets, and we went to Trafalgar Square. And as we're approaching it, we're hearing this cheering, and then we're hearing booing and cheering and booing. And I'm saying, whoa, are they getting ready for a soccer game or something? And we walked right into a huge protest against Brexit. And when I mean a huge protest, this wasn't like a block-long protest. This wasn't like two blocks. This was like miles long, this protest. We found out the next day that there were at least 30,000 people at that demonstration. And that was our first day. It was such an awesome welcome to London. And the amazing thing is the people were very passionate. They were very angry, but you didn't see the police going after them. You didn't see them going after the police. Every now and then the police would, say, mind yourself there. And, they're like, oh, okay, we're cool. We're cool. We're sorry. I think we could learn something from that in this country. Actually, a lot of countries could learn something from that. I couldn't ask for a better welcome to have such a passionate welcome to London. And after we took in the protest for a while, we went to the National Gallery, which is a freaking awesome museum. Even if you are not into art, I think you will be into art once you start roaming that museum. Beautiful place. And from there, after 6 days in London, we took a cruise. We got kind of like the Whitman's chocolate sampler version of vacationing. The cruise took us to Ireland, Scotland, and the last day was France. And so we got to sample several different cities and several countries. And we loved them all, but the one that we loved above all was Edinburgh, Scotland. We were only there for one day, but we fell in love with that city, and we really, really hope to go back. In fact, we loved it so much, towards the end of the day, Elena noticed a real estate office and said, let's go look at prices of houses. And I'm saying, yeah, maybe we could retire here. And, of course, that was the heat of the moment. We don't know anybody there. But what a city. I mean, it has something for everybody, at least from what we saw in one day. There's very touristy stuff for tourists like us. We were able to get all the touristy items to take home to our friends. There's a lot of very hip places, a lot of family-oriented places. What a beautiful town. The architecture is just mind-blowing. I will tell anybody, if you go to Edinburgh and plan on spending one day there, plan to spend two, because as soon as you get off the bus, you're going to walk around a corner and say, oh my God, look at that beautiful structure, and take pictures of it. Then you'll walk down to the next block and say, oh my God, there's another beautiful structure. I must take pictures. The people who live in Edinburgh probably think we're all nuts for snapping so many pics of their buildings, but they're beautiful. They're beautiful. And from what we saw of the people in Edinburgh, they're super friendly people. I don't know if that's because we were tourists and they were trying to, but they seem, people seem genuinely friendly. In France, they didn't seem quite as jazzed to see tourists.
Well, you also were in France at like a weird time, right? Because it was either after or during the Euros. Right, and then was it around the same time as like the post-Euro bombing that happened?
Yeah, the incident in Nice.
Yeah,
that it was days after that, and we were on the ship and we were at sea on the day it happened. We were just kind of up in one of the restaurants, just some of us playing cards, and then one of our friends, she came down and says, guys, I just heard something on the news, and we didn't know if it was going to compromise the trip. And the day we went to Paris, the only thing that you could really see that was different was everywhere you went, they were looking through people's purses before you went into a museum or even the restrooms at the Eiffel Tower. I mean, when you're going to the restrooms, people would check if you had purses or frisk you, and I can understand that. We saw Paris the wrong way. We saw it just for one day, and it was like a two-hour bus ride that turned into 3 hours because of traffic, so we had to get rushed through the Louvre, and then it's cool seeing the Eiffel Tower and being on it, but you're having to beware pickpockets there. I guess they have it down to a really fine art, because the guides spent it seemed like they spent like half the time warning us, beware the pickpockets. But we'd love to see France in a different in, under different circumstances one of these days.
Because I think, if I remember right, like France, I think had been under a state of emergency since the bombings last year,
Yes.
and then, like you said, the they had a month of the Euros where, there were pockets of hooligan stuff. I don't think in Paris, but still, you probably have a feeling that, that having all of those tourists there for a month, people were probably ready for to get back to normal, and then the Nice bombing happened. So yeah, so that probably was just poor timing.
Exactly. Just it was the perfect storm. And what was I going to say? Oh, but yeah, Scotland's our place. We want to go back. And yes, the Drummond name is actually from my family, so I hope to go back so I can go see the Drummond Castle.
Well, I know for a fact that we have Scottish listeners, including some that do live in Edinburgh, so I'm sure they'll be very
Oh,
happy
very
to
cool.
know that you had a good time in their city.
Yeah, in fact, next time we go to Europe, that's what we're primarily going to focus on, is we want to stay a while in Edinburgh. Just a fun place. Just even just looking at the place is nice. I could just park myself on a bridge there.
Well, I know. I
Another
mean,
interesting thing that I saw both there and also in London on some of the bridges, there's little, notices of suicide hotlines. I guess there's several bridges where people sometimes take a leap, and they actually have some suicide hotlines ads for that purpose, which I thought was pretty cool.
I know when I went, which admittedly was as a teenager, but I think still the thing that amazed me then, and I think probably is true for most Americans, is, that our history is, 300 years old, if we're being kind. But but when you go and you're like, oh, this church is from the 10th century, or, this is from like 1300, and it's just like 300 years from when people, all we had were indigenous peoples running around here.
Oh,
You had all of
absolutely.
this civilization.
Yeah, and I love where I live, Southern California. I love it. But one of the things that really bugs me about it, and I don't know if it's kind of this way across the nation, but we'll have these buildings that are really treasured and people love them, and then somebody says, as Joni Mitchell says, the take down paradise and put up a parking lot. There was one time when the Olympic Auditorium was about to be bulldozed, and there's a number of buildings who sometimes they'll be spared the chopping blocks if there's a big enough public outcry, but there's others that it's just, oh, this building has history and they love it. We'll take some good pictures and we'll, before we destroy it. And it's kind of a shame. It's like the country never really grows up.
Well, plus in Southern California, you've got so much of a populace squeezed into a little tiny space. And it's not like, Southern California really isn't, horizontal the way New York is. So it's
Exactly.
just, the sort of urban sprawl. It's like
Yeah, it's
even.
definitely a different animal in that regard.
'Cause I know, like, the last time I was out there, I was lucky to mostly avoid, like the famous LA gridlock, 'cause I fortunately.
Yes, welcoming to anybody who is a visitor, and it's funny because I've been driving since I was 16, so that was 1978, and it's like the gridlock is just old hat to me now. Not that it doesn't get frustrating, but I just make sure I have something interesting to listen to on the radio or CD because I know it's a part of California that is not going to change in the near future.
I think I was just lucky because I think I was I, like I never was downtown, and I think like I went out to the airport area once, and then I think like we went to Carson to see soccer, but I think either it was at the right time or we were going in the right direction. So like we never got had that like, 2 hours to go 10 miles kind of
Right.
famous
And
gridlock.
some of that is a little exaggerated. I mean, like a lot of things, there's truth to it, but there's some exaggeration. It's like, it's not every day I get in the freeway and just sit in the gridlock. It's definitely there, but it's not like 24/7. And also, part of it is when you live in Southern California, you get a notion of, well, if you leave a little earlier, you miss the gridlock, which is what I do with work every day. I actually get into the area I work about a half hour earlier than I need to, just because even a difference of leaving 15 minutes later makes for a much longer ride.
Yeah, we have that at work where if you leave maybe like 5 minutes before everybody else does, you can get like right out. But if you leave when you're quote unquote supposed to, it can be like another 15 minutes.
Exactly. The difference of leaving 15 minutes, that's when traffic starts clogging up within just a few minutes' time. So I never thought I'd find myself being such an early bird, because I've always been a night person, definitely. But, well, out of necessity.
The funny thing about that is I remember not too long ago I was watching the pilot episode of Columbo,
Oh, no way.
and one well, it's funny, one of the plot points that sort of tips him off to things not being right is the murderer had gone from Los Angeles to San Diego. And while he was in San Diego, his partner was supposedly killed, I think like in their office. And he drove back from San Diego instead of just getting a flight, which Columbo thought was suspicious. And I'm just thinking, this is like 1973. One, you couldn't just go right to the airport and get a flight back. And two, it's like, would it really? And then, how long would the actual drive from San Diego to Los Angeles take? I know it's supposed to be like 2 hours, but how long would it really take?
And it depends when you go, because I remember when we used to do the monthly trips to Tijuana to the Auditorio on Friday nights. The only time we were all able to leave together was like five-ish, and so we just realized, okay, we're going to be in traffic for a while just on the five. But if we were able to leave maybe around noon, then yeah, we would have been there in 2 hours easily.
I
But
remember, I think one time I was going to drive, I was in San Diego and we were going to San Francisco. And like I had never like done that drive before. And
Oh
to us,
yeah,
but
I
I mean just like the sort of scenic go up one and the stereotypical thing. And Dr. Luch is like, trust me, it's not like the time that would take, it's not worth like the like 1 hour flight from like San Diego to
Oh,
San,
easily. If you
he's
take the
like.
scenic route, you're going to take forever. And if you take the quicker route, it's a long, drab, dry drive. I know this because my dad and I used to make the drive from Orange County to Sacramento, which is, not that far from San Francisco. That was an 8 hour drive that we'd make every couple of weeks because my mom had taken a government job there. And you're just driving one straight line, Highway 5, which is the most, how would you say, the most generic highway you could ever drive. It's the quickest way, but it's a very long, boring drive.
I want to thank you once again for doing the show. Do you know when you and Fredo are doing the next Lucha World podcast?
Yes, we will be doing it in the next couple of days, so that we're hoping there will be a new podcast up in, by the middle of the week. And yeah, we were on a roll where we're getting it every other week, and we're kind of off kilter a bit, but trying to get it back on schedule.
And I know you've been doing some guest hosting around the wrestling podcast world too.
Yeah, I've been on both Fred Lazarus's show and also Brian Last, the show that he was doing with the David Vixenspan, now having revolving co-hosts. And I'm very, very honored that he chose me on several occasions to co-host. And I love this show. This is one of the best podcasts I've come across in eons. What's, I don't know if this is how the show was designed or if they just kind of stumbled on it, but they've really kind of brought back the interest of journeymen who have been long forgotten, like Chris Colt. Why is my mind going blank? Oh, Bull Curry. old timers remember him, but there's a lot of present day fans who are hearing about these guys for the first time. And Chris Colt is a guy who I would hate for his name to disappear into history. And I really feel like, the involvement and the intrigue. Both David Vixenspan and I are both guys who have been intrigued with Chris Colt for years. And not only are they kind of bringing that part of history back, but they talk a lot about a lot of the really active hardcore fans starting from the 70s into the 90s. And it's really awesome because I remember when I started reading the newsletters back in the late 1970s, being pen pals with some of these more prolific fans, the people like John Arezzi, Mike O'Hara, Bill Hill, Tom Burke, of course, and they're painting a really good history of what the hardcore fan scene was and how it evolved over the years, from the days of just being pen pals into being tape traders once VCRs were in every home, and then eventually internet connections. And I don't know if that was kind of their plan, but whether it kind of took on a force of its own or, they dreamed it up, man, I recommend the podcast to everybody.
It's amazing how, I mean, just talking about wrestling, how many good but very different kinds of shows there are now. It's sort of like you can be sort of as niche as you want to be, and there's still probably going to be a decent sized audience for it.
Yeah, it's like there is something for everybody out there. If you if you promote it right, if you know how to hype it right, promote it right, and find the crowd, you're probably going to find an audience for it. There's people who are into just the hardcore wrestling. It's not my cup of tea, but there's an audience for it. Audience for old school, audience for just about anything.
The one that I really enjoyed of late, and I think I've mentioned this before, is some of the territorial history stuff that Chris has done on Exile. Like, I know the one that I really liked was they did like a history of like the top 25 angles, like in Florida history. And
Oh,
some of that
really?
stuff, and some of that stuff I knew, and some of that stuff I didn't, and some of it I'd only heard about but never really heard the context. And so, because a lot of my Florida knowledge is just sort of like the 80s stuff that everybody sort of knows. But like a
Yeah.
lot of the yeah, like a lot of the 70s stuff, I had heard about, and some of the 60s stuff I just had like no idea. So I thought that was really cool, and I know he did a show with Scott Bowden not that long ago about Memphis, and Scott was on our show sometime last year, and I know he did like this huge series about Continental with Bo James, which was really cool. And I've got some stuff coming from, because Bo had like a sale not that long ago, and I got a bunch of like 85, 86 Continental stuff coming, and that's stuff like I've always been interested in that area, but like I've only known bits and pieces. So,
Yeah,
'cause
and what I love also is there is a lot of stuff that we're assuming has been lost, but it seems like every couple of weeks somebody will post something that has survived the video vaults over the ages. One, like both Brian and Dix were talking about, one of the famous Bull Curry versus Johnny Valentine matches. And every now and then, somebody on YouTube just put up a match between Killer Buddy Austin and a guy named Dave Cox out of Los Angeles in the 60s. And, we're continually told that all the old LA stuff has been erased, and I bet a lot of it has, but every now and then something will still pop up.
well, it's like Matt sent me a link the other day that I haven't watched it yet, but it was a bunch of Maple Leaf stuff. And I know there's like a little of that on YouTube, but this, I don't know if this is all new stuff that's just shown up. But, it's a kind of thing where, we talked about the last Battle of Atlanta, which everybody was assumed was lost forever. And then if you believe the official story, it was just in footage that they had that just said Omni when they were going through it, and somebody realized what they had.
What I wonder is here, one of the great things about being a wrestling fan in Southern California in the 70s is there were a lot of UHF stuff that would just air for a short period of time, other promotions. Of course, the first one I ever saw was the Argentina wrestling, Titanes en el Ring. And then in 1977, a local station, UHF station, Channel 18, was showing All Japan Women. So that was my first introduction to the Japan Women with Jackie Sato and Maki Ueda, the beauty pair, and Sandy Parker, who was a great worker. And then some of Mildred Burke's workers were on those shows. And then every now and then you would come across a station that unscheduled be just showing. There's one that was showing wrestling from somewhere in Mexico. I don't know where it was. Well, definitely wasn't Arena Mexico, which was the only time I ever saw the wrestler called America Salvaje, who was a masked wrestler, one of the Escobedo family in Mexico back in the 60s and 70s.
Well, we
So
when
I wonder if those tapes are still sitting in those vaults, because I hear every now and then that's how people find it, is they'll find something in a TV vault that, like you said, has a generic listing like Omni or wrestling or something like that. I wonder, is there a way to get access to them? And Ricky Itake was saying that sometimes if you can kind of get your foot in the door and talk to somebody and say, hey, is there any way I can, if I do something like a doc or index them for you. If I go through each tape and index them, if there's any way I can get copies, sometimes they'll be open to it. So
Well, that's
I
funny
wonder.
because there were people, I think it was like a year or two ago, somebody offered to like index and digitize like all of Dave's stuff that he has on video. Just to make sure that like it didn't get lost, cuz I don't know. I mean, I've only been to Dave's house once, and I saw the pile of videotapes that everybody else sees, but it's like you wonder just how methodical that, like if Dave said, I want to watch this, thing that I think I have on tape from Georgia from like 1982, because I'm sure Dave probably still has his videotapes from 1982. It's like, could he find it?
Well, that's the funny thing. I remember because I've never been to his house, but for back in the 80s, every now and then he'd come down here and we'd have big video bash parties where a lot of just the local observer readers would gather at my apartment or my house at the time, and just watch wrestling all night. And Dave would bring a big stack of tapes. And I can't remember what was on the labels, but it wasn't anything telling, just a little scratch of it. Didn't I don't even think it was a full word. And I'm saying, how do you know which tape is which? But somehow he knew. I don't know what his secret was, but
I did that like about
very minimally. They had minimal identification on each one.
Well, that's a couple of months ago, I had decided that I was going to try and start converting some of my videotapes to put on disc. And I now I have like all these blank tapes from sort of like 10 years ago from when I lived in Virginia. And I know like a lot of them have like the CMLL shows on there.
Yeah.
So it's just a matter of like I had no idea like what was on what. And I was, you know, I luckily, because this is I think 2004 maybe. It's like, yeah, I put like the one tape in and it's like all of a sudden, hey, look. It's maskless Rey Mysterio teaming with Santo and Casas. And I'm like, I don't remember this, but boy, this is weird.
I love, oh, wow. That's half the fun of being an old school wrestling fan is the stuff that pops up here and there. Just the last few years on YouTube, they showed a bunch of 1960s wrestling from France. And I don't know if you've seen that, but that is some amazing wrestling.
Yeah. Well, it's funny. It's like a little while ago, I don't know what I was doing, but I was doing something on YouTube. And then I think I must have been watching some kind of lucha. But then you know what weirdly showed up was, and I think this was from L.A. because I think Jimmy Lennon was the ring announcer. But it was it was Andre in a handicap match versus Gordman and Goliath.
Oh, that's a famous one. That's been floating around for quite a few years, yeah.
But I was just like, this is just oddly random. And then he just squashed him, which was sort of even more interesting, because it's like, I don't know if it's because that was like at their end of the time there or what, but I was just like, you'd think these guys would have a little, I mean, especially if it's a handicap match, and those two were so big in Los Angeles.
I think that kind of went around. I think the reason that survived was, I think a lot of territories used that to show when they were hyping Andre coming into town. Like they said, Andre's coming in, you know, let us show you what he does, you know, with two top stars, you know, and Gordman and Goliath, who did a great selling job in those matches. I still today say Black Gordon Goliath as a team, I think, is the greatest heel team I've ever seen. And Black Gordon as a heel is easily on my top five heels of all time list. Amazing, amazing worker.
It is just such an amazing, there's so much stuff out there. You know, between like what's just on YouTube or Daily Motion or something like that, and then, you know, you've got all of the places that stream nowadays, and so.
Yes. Because we know only more stuff is going to be found, and it's a grab bag. You have no idea what has survived and what has totally vanished.
Hopefully at some point in the not too distant future, we were going to have Bruce Tharp on to talk about the NWA streaming service that has all of that Houston Paul Bosch stuff.
I would love to hear that. I'd love to see some of that. I mean, because I know Bosch had, well, for somebody like me, Bosch had a lot of those, used a lot of the people like Connect, Medico Assassino, Gordman Goliath, Grand Marcuse. I know they held Grand Marcuse in high regard in Houston. You ever look for the stuff in France, I've only seen one match with them, but there was a tag team in, I think, the late 50s or early 60s. Two guys, Bobby Duranton and René de Lacertese. They are one of the best pretty boy tag teams I've ever seen. Just had the gimmick down. I guess Duranton actually worked the States on and off, but his home was primarily in France.
Yeah, I know some of the, I think like this, like Phil and some of the Segunda Caieta guys are really high on that, on the France stuff.
It is amazing wrestling. I remember seeing him in the After mags in the mid 60s, but I finally got to see the French wrestler Quasimodo. And it's funny, you see him in the ring and he looks like he's going to be this Abdul the Butcher type. And while he is full on heel, he actually freaking wrestles. And it works too. It wasn't what I was expecting.
It's like hopefully nobody ever showed that guy stuff to Jim Herd. And that may be why where he got the hunchback idea.
I He's saying, I was wrong about making Ric Flair into the gladiator. I'll have him be the hunchback. Just get a mallet and pound on his shoulders for a while till they swell, and we have our hunchback.
Well, Mr. Vandal Drummond, man of many names, thank you again for doing the show. Like you said, people can look for, hopefully, for you and Fredo to have a new Lucha World out this week, and we will talk to everybody next time.